on my mind that's driving me crazy. Why do I need to see those blue eyes looking at me that way again? After the way she did me, it's a sin. How could she just walk out and leave me? After all these nights in her arms, look where I am. And I've got $2 in the jukebox, $5 in the bottle, and more just in case that don't do the trick. And I'll be dead broke tomorrow morning, with heartaches by the dozen, and a lady on my mind that's driving me crazy.
And welcome, everyone, to Your Money, Your Matters on Blog Talk Radio. And we're certainly glad that you have joined us again for a very fine Tuesday with a little Eddie Rabbit in the background. Kind of have to expect that when the show originates down here in Texas land. So we've got to have a little bit of, maybe a little bit of Nashville country western music all rolled into it. Depends upon, I guess, how Eddie defines his blend of music. But that's quite okay, because we aren't talking about music on this show. We're talking about money and maybe the song it makes as we have it in our savings account or we use it wisely. And that is what we will spend the next hour talking about, is what is going on within our money world. Your Money, Your Matters is brought to you every Tuesday by the Cornerstone Credit Union League, the Cornerstone Credit Union Foundation, and Consumer Credit Counseling Service of Greater Dallas. So we certainly are glad that you have joined us and hope that you will join us on the air if you would like. You can give us a call at 646-929-1020. That's 646-929-1020. And if you would like to talk on the air, just press the number one key. That will raise your digital paw, and we will know that we need to bring you in on the air. If not, you can listen, of course, across the telephone. That may be the most expensive way to do it. You can listen to it across the Internet as well. And if you would like to comment while you are listening to it on the Internet or some other device other than your telephone, you can always use our chat room, and the chat room is open. We are watching that as well for guests to come in. And as you join that, just let us know what's on your mind, what your thoughts are, what your concerns are, and we will try to address that while we're on the air. So it's been a couple of weeks since we have broadcast. Rick Grady, have been out of town, down in the capital city, basically spending time with legislators, talking about issues that are going on within the financial world. And so I spent my time there, and unfortunately the appointments were at the approximately the same time that the radio show was going to be on the air. And so I will recap some of our discussions on that, but I unfortunately and apologize that we were not on the air for a couple of weeks, and we'll try to avoid that certainly in the future. And all those people know that in the state of Texas they only meet for 140 days every other year. That's because they all ride horses back to El Paso, and it takes them that long to get back home and then back to the legislature. So, covered wagons, are still in style. But it also allows those issues to come forward and play out over a period of time rather than having the sessions going on and on and on. But, of course, in Oklahoma and Arkansas, those sessions are continuous sessions, and so we're watching the bills there and watching the bills in Washington, D.C. So, and that's what we do from the Cornerstone Credit Union League, a little bit differently than the Foundation and Consumer Credit Counseling Service of Greater Dallas. But again, we are glad that you are here joining us and want to talk about your financial matters and what may be going on. As an economist, and that's kind of my background, my background is very eclectic, and one of those things is the economy and statistics, and those are the types of things that I typically watch. And if you saw today's Wall Street Journal, you probably saw a article on the money page talking about consumers get cold feet on credit. That was the headline. That caught my eye, and I decided that I really needed to read that. And I guess there's a positive and negative side to that. There's two sides to that coin. I don't know if they're positive or negative, but there are two sides to the story. The good thing is that y'all as consumers have certainly decided that Maybe savings is a good idea, and maybe not having a whole lot of credit is not a good idea. And so you want to avoid as much credit as you want, especially that high interest type credit that basically is just continues to float around. And we call that credit cards. Now, again, we're not against credit cards here, but what we are against is the abuse of credit cards. And the abuse of credit cards basically comes when you decide, gosh, I have a balance on there, I'll pay the minimum payment, and I'll let it roll over to the next month. Don't do that, because over a period of time, that adds up to a considerable amount of interest and certainly a considerable amount of additional expenditures that you really don't have to do. So when you put things on your credit card, as we all have advised people to do, either keep that sales slip or take out a piece of paper and write down so you know exactly what's on your credit card. And when you get to the limit that you know that's what you can pay off at the end of the month, then stop. Don't use that anymore. It's good to use a credit card, but it's not good to abuse a credit card. And if you are able to pay it off at the end of the month, this will help your FICO score. So not only does it show that you have revolving credit and that you live up to the terms of the revolving credit by paying it off in full and on time, but it also shows that you have a greater availability of credit, and that will increase your FICO score. So those that have been struggling for years and years with a low FICO score, one of the things that you can work with your financial institution, primarily a credit union, because of the terms that they typically put on those, and they're willing to work with you, is get a credit card and use it very wisely. Now, if you can't afford to put a lot on a credit card, two things that you want to do when you establish it, don't have a real large limit put on. Don't ask them for $3,000 or $5,000 or $10,000 limit on a credit card. Ask them for a $500 limit or something small, something that's manageable, something that you can do. And then the other thing that you want to do is make sure, again, that you keep a list of all of the charges that you put on your credit card and make sure that you're able to pay that off at the end of the month. That will certainly help you out a great deal, and that's exactly where you want to be and what you want to do. So, again, a credit card is a good tool, but don't abuse it. But anyway, consumers have been dialing back the amount of credit that they have wanted. The Economist survey by the Wall Street Journal forecasted that borrowing rose only $12.1 billion in the month of February, and that's compared to a year ago when it rose $15.5 billion. So it's $3 billion less in the amount of credit. Now, further analyzing those numbers, what the economists have discovered is that people are willing to have such things as an automobile loan, which, again, is a good thing if you can afford it and make sure that you pay it. And they have been getting student loans, which, as you know, people that have talked with me, I'm, you know, six of one, half a dozen another on student loans. I would prefer that a person go to college and they work very, very diligently, not only at their studies, but very, very diligently at a job or save money between, you know, now and the time they go to college, so that they can pay their bills. And if you really have an income level where you can't afford a lot, you don't have to go to the top name schools without scholarships. I mean, I would apply for scholarships, I would apply for grants, I would do everything in my power to find dollars that I would be awarded and would not have to repay. And they're done off of my academics or some other means. I mean, we certainly see scholarships giving out for athletics, but for those that are not athletically inclined, it's you know, basically academics and various other things, civic duties that you've done. But there's certainly lots of ways of getting some additional dollars in there to help pay those bills. And then you want to live wisely. One of the things might be is that you don't want to choose a college far away from home. Yeah, it's great when you're 18 and I'm going to get away from the parents finally and move out and be on my own and be independent. And then when you find that you're independent, you find all of those things that are now going to start costing you money as an independent person. You know, you've graduated, congratulations. And so now you're into things that you have to spend a great deal of money on that you may not have spent a great deal of money on before. And so you have to start budgeting for those types of things. And we're talking about the basic stuff. I mean, food, clothing, and shelter are pretty basic. And you would need those when you go to college. You need some place to live. You need, obviously, some clothes so that you don't freeze to death. And you want some food so that you can keep your system going so that you can go to your classes. So you need money for that. You need money for your textbooks. You need money to pay the tuition to get into the college. All those things have to be engineered in a budget if you're going to go off to college. And so student loans, to me, are just simply putting off some of the inevitableness. We have seen that with the millennials in the past, where the millennials have, many of them, and I shouldn't say all of them because there's a lot of them that did not, but there was a good chunk of them that decided that they were going to take out student loans. And they took out student loans for absolutely every bill that they ever had in their entire college career. And at the end of their college career, they're ending up looking at somewhere between $30,000 and $50,000 as a debt, maybe more. I mean, it depends upon whether they went on and got a master's degree, or it depends upon what their degree program really was. But they have a huge chunk of money that they have to repay. And the problem with that huge chunk of money is that it's not going to go away. Most student loans, and certainly the federal loans, are not dissolvable through any kind of bankruptcy. So you can't, for example, have a plan. And hopefully this is not your plan, but I've had people tell me that that's their plan. Is to go through college and then on the other end declare bankruptcy. Well, guess what? The student loans stay there. And the law was written in such that way that people wouldn't, you know, go through colleges, spend a four-year degree, then declare bankruptcy and walk away with a free degree. I mean, you have to put something into this kitty to be able to get the degree, and part of that is the responsibleness for the debt. So, all that being said, I would encourage anybody when they're going to look at any kind of student loan to determine how much debt can I withstand and how much can I pay off by taking a job while I'm at college. Certainly, the college counselors many times will have a program within the university or the college that provides jobs for students. There are many jobs typically on campus. I know because I took jobs while I was on campus. There were several jobs, different types of jobs that I had when I was on campus. And so you can earn money from the university while you're going to school by also doing things for the university. The other thing is certainly the community around it. Many of them have jobs for students, and I would certainly go out and take a look at those and see if you can't secure one of those to help pay down some of your debt. And then you just have to manage your time wisely as you go to college and determine how much you can afford to work and put in to receive a paycheck, and how much can you devote to studies. And then, of course, you've got sleep and eating, and then the very last thing is playtime. So you want to be very, very careful with the playtime there, and then determine exactly how much free time you're going to allow yourself when you're doing all those types of things. But the benefit of it is, the struggle is, the devotion of it is that after 4 years or 4 years plus, depending upon what your program is, you have established yourself a baccalaureate, and certainly that is going to help you in the working world. In some programs, maybe a master's will help you more in the working world, but at least having a college degree and showing that determination and going through college helps you in the working world. If you don't think that, I would encourage you to either write me a note so I can show you the statistics on what the unemployment rate is for those that have graduate degrees, BA degrees, and high school degrees and no high school degrees, so that you can see the difference, and you can also see the wage earning potential of an individual that has a graduate degree, a bachelor's degree, a high school degree, and some high school. They're significantly different over a longer period of time. And if what you want to do is, from a monetary standpoint, lift yourself up a little bit by going out and getting a degree, then all power to you. Go ahead and do that, because you will earn a little bit more over a period of time. I say a little bit because, you know, it really sometimes it's large and sometimes it's small. So, I mean, let's be very honest. There are some bachelor's degrees that people get in certain subject matters that are wonderful. I mean, and there's a lot you can do with it. I'm certain there's a lot you can do with it, but there's not a lot of calling for that profession in the open world. And if you're not willing to find something to do that with, then, you know, you struggle for a period of time. I know that I certainly saw that when one of my roommates graduated with a BA degree in philosophy. Well, you know, how many philosophers do you see walking around society? And, you know, you go to a building and hire a philosopher. Not a lot of people hire philosophers. And so I always asked him, why did you get a philosophy degree? And one of the reasons was is that he enjoyed debate. And he took those skills and went and applied to the law school, took his LSATs, passed his LSATs, applied and was accepted at a very good law school and became a very good attorney. And he used those skills in philosophy and those skills in debate learned through getting a degree in philosophy in the courtroom as a very good trial lawyer. So those types of things can be very, very useful. But if you decide that I'm going to get myself a BA in English and that's all I'm going to do with it, I hope that you're a very, very good writer. I have a friend that was in high school, and he studied English very, very well, became a very fabulous journalist, and wrote numerous books and is continuing to write several books and has done very well writing books. You know, that's an absolutely wonderful trait. He certainly has his grammar, his use of the English language is much better than mine. But again, that wasn't my leaning. My leaning was math and science. So that's kind of where I went. Anyway, the consumers have not been putting out a lot of money. Certainly, they've been getting automobiles. And we do see that this year a lot more automobiles are going to be certainly sold than last year. We're predicting that probably 17 to 17.5 million automobiles will be purchased this year on top of all of the used cars. And so people are taking out loans for automobiles, and people are taking out loans for student loans, but they are not taking out credit card loans, which is the reason that consumer credit fell to some degree. And to a degree, that's okay. I don't have a problem with that. Now, on the flip side of it, in the trade association where I am employed, the members of our trade association would probably have a problem with it because people aren't borrowing. And if they're not borrowing, then they're not paying any the money back plus the interest. The interest is called revenue to a credit union or a bank. And so they're not gaining in revenue. And so it hurts the financial institution when people don't borrow. And when people save more than they borrow, then the credit union can be kind of upside down in a ways because they're not earning revenue, yet they have the expense of dividends on the savings accounts, and that really hurts the margins. The margins get so thin that it's very, very difficult to operate the rest of the operation within the margins of a financial institution. So if you've never studied a financial institution and want to, they're very interesting beings. They're not like a retail store of any sort. I mean, you might see a retail banking operation, which deals with consumers like you and me when we walk in the door. Or you might see investment bankers that deal with people with a lot of wealth that want to do investments of some sort. But if you see a retail bank, typically that's where you have your savings accounts and your checking accounts and your auto loans and your home loans and those types of things are in your retail banking. And just because the word retail is established on there doesn't mean it works like a retail model that you've ever seen. You have to go in and take a look at a financial institution to really see how a credit union or even a bank balances money every single day. They buy and sell money every single day, and there's a balance in buying and selling money every single day. And so that is a very delicate balance. There's very thin tenths of percentage margins in there that they have to live on, and you have to do a lot of that. It has to be significant volume in order to make enough money to employ a few people to keep the financial institution going. So When the economists say that the consumer credit has fallen, from a business standpoint, and certainly from an investor who reads the Wall Street Journal's standpoint, this is not a good thing because the stock that they have in financial institutions may go down because they're not going to be paying as many dividends, and therefore they probably don't want to hold as many financial institution stocks. But on the consumer's end of it, I have to applaud you. From the standpoint of a consumer and wisely saying, I do not want to get into debt above my eyeballs or I do not want to get in debt above my belt line, is a real good thing to do because it means that you have a good handle on it and you've got some money that you're salting away for future years and establishing yourself a very good savings account. So I would always encourage people to do that, and I would encourage people to have more than one savings account, one of which you do not touch, one of which you just put money away. Maybe it's a 401k, your parents, and this is the message to young couples that are deciding to have a child. This is the first thing that you do when you bring the child home. You call the financial institution and you establish yourself a 529. You want to start saving for this child's future education of some sort. Now, whether you want to put it into a 529 savings account or whether you wanted to put it into some other type of vehicle, that is certainly up to you. If you think that your child's not going to college, I suppose that would be the wishy-washy point of determining, well, I don't want to put it there because it has to be earmarked for some types of education. But there are lots of sources in education that people can use those dollars for. So investigate them wisely and determine which ones are the best and determine which ones have the most latitude to them. And then begin to invest a little bit of money off into 529s for your kids or some types of savings account, and certainly something that they can use to pay for their education so they don't have to take out student loans. And if you're a young millennial right now that may be hitting that 34, 35-year-old, you are the leading edge in the millennials. And now is the time that you're deciding, gosh, you know, I've been with this person for a very long period of time. Let's get married. Let's have a family. Let's buy a house. And that's what I'm really seeing out in the community right now is the determination that we want to go out and we want to begin establishing a family environment. And that's a good thing, even though, you know, you put it off 14 years later than most generations before you. But, I mean, who cares? Who's counting? I mean, it doesn't make any difference, to be real honest. You know, it's a good thing to pay the student debts off that you ran up and think, I never want my kid to go through this. I know that was my parents' thoughts when I talked to them about myself going to college and how we were going to pay for that because we were a very large family. And the dad was the sole breadwinner, you know, I could see the pain on his face every 15 days as he would sit at the counter and pay bills and scratch his forehead as to how much money is he going to put in the savings here and how much money he's going to put in short-term savings for house expenses and various other things. And he was dividing this stuff out, and I mean he was dividing out pennies. I could see it on his face, but his statement to me was, I don't want you to experience what I experienced. Now, my parents, when they went through college, also went through college right around the time of the Great Depression. And so those that are students of history will realize what took place during the Great Depression and how much of a struggle that was for society. For them to be able to put themselves through college during that period of time and be able to pay the bills, meaning they had something that they were doing that earned income or their parents were not severely beaten on by the economy, that they were able to afford some as well, meant some very good things. Now, I will be very honest to tell you that my father's college was supplemented by both his dad, and then when his dad died at a very young age, his uncle who was a medical doctor, helped furnish some of the dollars, not all of them, but some of the dollars to go to college. My dad worked while he went to college to help pay the bills because there was no such thing as a student loan. So all the when the bill came due for tuition and books, you paid the bill or you weren't in that semester. So he had to be able to not only earn it, but he had to put it into a savings account in some place. And remember, Great Depression, banks went bust. And so he had to put it someplace so that when that tuition bill came up, the money was there and he was able to pay for it the same way with my mother. Now, again, in all true honesty, my mother's dad was a very good defense lawyer. He was a good not only defense lawyer, but he was also a prosecutor for the state. And so he continued to earn money during the Great Depression and was able to funnel some of those bills, but he didn't pay them all. One of the things that they both did was that they would pay a portion for their kids to go to college, but their kids had to put some money into the game. This wasn't going to be a free ride. They had to have something in the game. So both of them worked very hard to get their degrees. They didn't want their kids to experience that. So originally, my dad said, well, you know, his feeling was he's just going to pay the full boat. Well, I told him that there was no way that he was going to do that for me. And, you know, there were so many kids that all of us decided that that would be fairly unfair. I mean, that wasn't a good thing to do. So all of us had some form of additional income. And when I went to school, college, during the 1960s, and for a lot of you that was way before you were born, but in the late 60s, early 70s, student loans were just coming out, and they really weren't of fashion to be candid at that point. You could apply for grants and scholarships and those types of things, but all of us in the family really got jobs. We did things at the university, or we did things that were in the commercial world. I can tell you that my older brother pumped gas. I actually worked at a radio station. I also did things at the university. I was in the cafeteria serving line for about a year, you know, working in a cafeteria. And while you're on the cafeteria serving line, you went back and washed dishes, too. And so those were the types of things. I also did some cinematography for a summer at the university and traveled around the state photographing things, filming things for the agricultural department. So there's other ways of earning while you're at the university. Some of my friends supplemented the janitorial staff of the university and then would go around and clean the classrooms in the evening prior to or after studying for the evening. So, again, they were earning an income in order to afford their student loans. Now, is the university or our university tougher today than they have been in the past? Technically, I don't think so. I mean, I've talked to a lot of people that are in the universities today, and I'm talking to them about the classes that they're taking, and I think they're just as tough now as that they were before. And yes, when I went there in the 70s, my stuff is written in the history books. Your stuff is not. So, I mean, there's another 40 years worth of history in there. On top of what I had to learn, but still, I think that it's not, statistics are statistics, inorganic and organic chemistry is inorganic and organic chemistry. The compounds haven't changed all that much, and they're just as tough as they have been in the past. The English language hasn't changed that much, although, you know, we now have tweets and all kinds of other, shortcuts through the English language, but still a lot of it is the same. So the courses are just as tough to get through as they have before, which simply says that there are opportunities out there to be employed. Pay the bills. If you can do it, I would strongly encourage anybody going to college today to see how much of that college debt that they can pay off by using savings over a period of time. and using income that they earn from a job. And if you're able to do that, you will come out of college without any debt, and that's a great place to be, because as you start earning income in the real world, you're able to do a couple of things with it. You can put part of it away for long-term savings. This is the money I'm going to have when I am 65, 70, 75 years old, and I want to be able to put my feet up on a beach and look at the palm trees sway back and forth while I drink a Mai Tai. And you might want to have a secondary account that says, this is stuff I want in the near term. I don't want it today, but in the near term, I would like to have a house, you know, maybe like my parents at some time. I'm going to get a starter house first, and then I'm going to work my way up. Now, speaking of houses, let me give you a little bit of an idea here. You don't have to go for the mansion immediately. To be candid, when I finally moved out of the house and got my first place, my first place was an apartment, and I rented. And I saved money while I was renting. Now, I also realized that, you know, every dollar I put to rent, I could have put to a mortgage. So, you know, I knew that by looking at it, but I did not have the money saved up to do a down payment on any type of home. So over a period of time, I saved and saved and saved in what I would call your midterm savings account so that I could afford a down payment. So that, you know, at that time, when you bought a home, you paid 20% down. If you didn't have 20%, and let's say that you were going to buy an $80,000 home, a starter home, $80,000 starter home, which sounds crazy that an $80,000 home is a starter home, but $80,000, you're going to pay $16,000 cash on top of that. And now in today's market, with the scarcity of existing homes, you might have to pay a premium on that house. So it may be on paper that house has been appraised for, not assessed, you know, tax assessed. Don't pay any attention to that. That's always lower. But it's appraised, let's say, at somewhere around $80,000 to keep it all a good number. And let's say you have to pay a 10% premium on that in order to capture that, because there's so many people that are wanting that home. And by the way, there are lots and lots and lots of investors out there that's the cream puff of the home. The investors want to capture something between 75 and 125, and then they rent those out. So they're able to buy those homes and then turn them into lease properties, into rental properties, and actually begin to develop themselves a cash flow out of those homes. But the cream of those homes are between 75 and 125. So an $8,000 home, let's say you have to pay a 10% premium to capture it, that's $88,000. Now, on top of the $16,000 that you needed as a down payment, and I know that down payments are a lot less now because they're like 3 to 5%, but on top of the $16,000, you're going to have to pay another $8,000, so you're going to have $24,000 in cash, and that does not include the closing costs. So, you know, let's put it into modern terms. Let's say that it is a 5% down that you have to have, and I would encourage you to put more. I really do. Only from the standpoint is you don't want to ride a 30 more, and don't tell the financial institution this because the law frown. And I can understand. I mean, I'm a proponent of theirs, but I'm also not a proponent of keeping a 30-year mortgage for 30 years either. And so what I do is I say draw out a 30-year mortgage, and that'll get you very good terms, and then pay $100 extra each month so whatever the mortgage payment is going to be for escrow, for taxes and insurance and such, throw in an extra $100 on it, and you'll be surprised how over a period of time that mortgage gets paid off rapidly. So anyway, what you want to do is you want to take a look at it and say, okay, I want to buy that. I want to buy that home. Maybe it's only a 5% down at that time, so it's $4,000 that you have to cup up with cash, plus the $8,000 premium. So now you're talking $12,000. Maybe you need another $4,000 for closing costs. You're back to $16,000 that you need to save to buy an $80,000 home, and you need to keep it for a period of time, knowing that it will appreciate. Homes are appreciating, by the way. Maybe some people in the press haven't quite caught on to that, but I can tell you right now what's happening within the housing market, and that is that we're beginning to see a great demand for single-family attached and single-family detached homes. It was in the previous market leading into probably midpoint of last year that most people were doing renting, and the only reason that they were doing renting is because they couldn't afford a lot. You know, the recession of 18 months, actually probably more like 2 years, sucked the wind out of a lot of people's sales. A lot of people lost a great deal of money, and because it was the housing industry that plummeted, when the housing industry plummeted, it took everything down with it, and so it left a lot of people in a really bad spot in order to be able to afford a home. Their credit was bad. Maybe they were foreclosed upon, and there was a lot of homes that were out on the marketplace that were foreclosed upon homes that were basically diluting the rest of the market. And so housing prices plummeted from the standpoint is that I have an oversupply, I have very little demand, and all of a sudden the housing prices go down, which turns people upside down, and they called it being underwater. Drowning in mortgage debt is really what that meant. But the market has turned around now. And housing is beginning to increase in value. The existing homes, their price have come back in most locations. In some locations, that's not so, and it's going to take a great deal of time for the price to come back. For the reason is that they were probably inflated beyond what they were really valued in the first place, just because there was such a hot demand in the market at that point in time that people could get that kind of money for those homes, and now they can't anymore. But still, the housing market is coming back, and people are seeing a very good return on real estate. So when you take a look at that home, you know, certainly take a look at it as something that you want to ride for a long period of time. And I'm not saying that you're going to ride it for 30 years. I mean, most people don't stay in a home for 30 years. My guess is if, let's say, you're a millennial right now, you've paid off all your student debt, you've decided that what you want to do is invest in a home rather than renting, whether you're single, whether you're a couple, whether you're married, whether you're not, you want to invest into a home. And that's an okay thing to do. I will tell you from a investment manager's position, and I'm not one, but I know many, and they all talk this pretty much the same way. Your home is not the investment. If you were to buy a home that you were going to lease or rent to somebody, that is an investment. But your home in and of itself is not an investment. Although you would look at it as an asset, it is also a very giant liability. And the reason is that you go back to, you know, for those that took accounting in college, like myself, for those that have an accounting background, take a look at it as how it's on the books. And that basically says that when you come in, if you project 30 years forward the interest payments on your mortgage, you have a stronger liability than you have an asset on the books. And the hope is over a period of time that through cash flow, what you earned and what you can pay on the mortgage will take that mortgage down on the liability side. The asset will continue to grow. And at the end of the term, you'll end up with something called equity, which means that's the money that's left over that you get to keep. And so that's really what you're looking at. Now, I will tell you that the very first home that I bought was not a house in and of itself. It was a duplex. And the reason that I wanted to buy a duplex is because I wanted an income-earning property right next door. And a lot of people may not want that. But that's, you know, that's certainly okay for however you would like it. But what I wanted to do is I wanted income property right next door. I didn't want income property in another city. I didn't want income property in another state, because an absentee landlord type of situation is one of the ugliest things that can happen, because your property can literally be destroyed and you won't even know it. But having a duplex, certainly from an accounting standpoint and a tax standpoint, brings you a significant amount of advantages. First, you are next door to the person that you are renting to or leasing to, and so typically they're going to be a little bit more cautious than, you know, deciding that what they're going to do is have 160 of their friends over for, you know, some kind of toga party. So they probably are not going to do that. The other thing is that because the entire building is then considered a rental piece or an asset, you can depreciate one half of that building and then also use the money that you had to borrow and such from an accounting standpoint. You get depreciation, and actually at the end of doing your taxes, which, by the way, are coming up very, very quickly for many of you who have not done them yet, you procrastinators, you, and do them. You know, just go ahead and do them. You got 8 days. Do them, but if you when you do your income taxes with that kind of property, you get significantly more business deductions on there, and so you actually end up on paper, it looks like originally that you have a loss on the home. You're not getting as much income from it than you have to pay on a mortgage payment, and although you're getting income from the second side of the duplex, that probably actually does cover your mortgage payment, but it doesn't cover all the costs. And so you're able to then bank more money into it. And maybe if you're in a duplex neighborhood and you happen to like the duplex neighborhood, just keep your eyes open and see if one of the other properties goes up for sale, or keep your eyes to the real estate sheets and see if another one goes up for sale. And you can buy that one, too. Now you live next door to the duplex, and you've got three that you're renting out and one that you're living in, and that's really a good thing for you to do. If you don't want to do that, of course, you might end up buying a home. And don't think of it as, the long-term home. Don't get married to your home. Your home is a home, and it's very nice, and I understand that. And a lot of people really love their homes, and God bless them. I mean, that's a great thing to do. But don't get married to it to the point that you can't sit there and say, I'm going to sell this tomorrow. I'm going to take my money, I'm going to put it in the bank, and I'm going to walk away. Because at some point in time, you'll get to the stage where you're going to want to retire. Or you might find that there is another opportunity, another job being offered in some other city, and you want to go and take that. You know, there are many people I know that are moving into North Texas area out of California and Kentucky and New York, and those that are moving out of New York and those that are moving out of California that have homes there. The consideration is that, well, I will lease that. Well, that's a good thing and a not so good thing. I mean, a good thing is I can lease it. I can make a significant amount of money. I keep the property. It ends up at that point in time being an income-producing asset, and therefore that is an investment. It's a great thing that if maybe I decide I want to move back to California, I can then take my money from here, and I'll go back to California and live in the same house. I just won't renew the lease. The thing that people have to watch out for is that you better have somebody that's watching the property. Because if you're not watching the property, the lawn won't get mowed and various other things won't take place. The upkeep won't be done on the facility in and of itself. And all of a sudden, what was an income-producing asset is a giant liability. And you're going to have to go back and do a lot of fixing up, if not dealing with the liabilities of an improper structure. I would encourage anybody that moves away from a city, if that's what they want to do, is to find a management company that can take that property and manage it for you. For the few dollars that you're going to pay that management company, it's a whole lot more profitable to have them watch it, drive by it, every once in a while knock on the door and make sure that all the walls that were inside there are still in place. And nobody's decided to make a giant party room by removing everything but the support wall. You want to have somebody checking on the lawn and making sure that if you're in a homeowners association of sorts, that you're living up to the covenants of the homeowners association. All those things have to take place with home ownership. So I know this conversation kind of led off of the Wall Street Journal article of consumers having cold feet on credit, and I don't think that that's a bad thing. We learned a tremendous lesson when we went through the Great Recession. We are the generation, like my dad and like his parents, that went through the Great Depression and saw people standing on the street in bread lines. and people that, you know, highly educated that are now unemployed for long periods of time and that lose everything, and all of a sudden, including their credit rating, to the point that they have a hard time recovering from the credit rating, and so they can't buy into property as quickly as they want to again. So all of these types of things take place, and you just have to be, you know, very, very mindful of what's going on. I don't think it's as bad as the, you know, some of the writers in the Wall Street Journal might say. Yes, I understand that people aren't borrowing from financial institutions, and therefore the financial institutions probably aren't making as much money as they have in the past, and they're not paying the dividends out as heavily as they did. They're still making money. People are still borrowing. There is still a contingency of individuals that are borrowing, but they're shying away from credit card debt, and that's not a bad thing. If they can pay off their credit card debt, you know, it would be lovely, and the credit card company will hate me for this, is that at the end of the month, everybody paid off their credit card bill. You know, certainly they're charging things on it, and they get fees for that. They certainly get interest if you flip it from one month to another. Don't revolve your credit like that. But if it went, you know, up $15 billion and then went to zero at the end of the month because everybody paid off their credit card bill, it could go back up to $15 billion the next month and then go right back to zero at the end of the month because everybody paid off their credit card bill. You know, that will never happen. But I think that certainly from the standpoint of when I look at these types of things and I can see that the consumers aren't borrowing enough, but they're borrowing for some of the right things. Borrowing for a car so they have transportation from their home to work and back is a good thing, although I will encourage people to use mass transit if they have the possibility of doing that. And as we get into the future and gas gets more expensive, and maybe we get into, you know, alternate forms of transportation like electric cars or whatever it might be, we will probably see different forms of transportation going on. But in that vein, I would encourage any and all of you, I mean, a car is an okay investment as long as you have put money away, again, as long as you put money away for the maintenance. Every 3,000 miles to 5,000 miles, depending upon how the engine and the manufacturer recommends this, you're going to get the oil changed. You're going to get various things done to it. It's going to get a ding every once in a while. Somebody, you know, there are people in the parking lot that just don't care. And they're going to open their door or they're going to back into you and you're going to get a ding and you're going to need to get it fixed. So you're going to have to body shop it at some point in time. Hopefully it's nothing big, but, you know, at some point in time you've got some stuff that's going to happen to it, and we know that. But we know that we have to change the oil in it. We know that it has headlights and taillights and a light bulb to burn out. We're going to have to replace those. We're going to have tires on it, and, you know, and depending upon how good of a tire that we buy, and I'll tell you something about tires in a moment, but how good of a tire that we buy depends upon how many times that we're going to have to buy tires over a period of time. Now, what I was going to tell you about tires is that some tire companies, and I'll tell you the name of this one because I think that they did me very good, so I'm going to return the courtesy, Discount Tire. Discount Tire said, you know, for another, I want to say it was $20, for another $20 on each tire, or $80 for all the time. And this is a very costly insurance policy, to be real honest. They will, if anything happens to the tire during a period of time, and I believe that was 3 years or 4 years or so many miles, it was so many miles, I can't remember right off without looking at the piece of paper. If something happens to the tire, they will replace it for free. Well, something happened to my tire. Now, these tires are not what I would call inexpensive tires. These are not your, you know, $80 special tires that they're on there. I have put off-road tires on there because I go to the family cabin, and the family cabin's way in the back of the woods, and it's not paved, it's gravel, and it's dirt at times and mud. And so to get back there, I take the Jeep, and I have off-road tires on it. And each one of these tires is about $175, $200 a piece. So it was about 10%, you know, of the cost of each tire as an insurance policy on the tire. Well, you know, driving down the road one day, I took a piece of rebar from, you know, you see them all the time, the potholes that come up in the wintertime. Well, within concrete to hold all of that stuff together is rebar, and evidently this pothole had a piece of rebar in it that was loose, and my tire took that rebar right through the tire, and it embedded itself in the tire, so it was a slow leak. And when I took it down to the dealership wondering what this was that was sticking into my tire, I thought it was a big construction nail, and he said, no, it's a piece of rebar. And so the tire was destroyed, so I got a brand new tire for free. Now, it could have cost me $200, but it didn't. It cost me $20. So that was well worth the investment. Now, will that happen to everyone? I will tell you that on my daughter's car, who uses those little low-ride tires, whatever you call those things, which I detest, and one of these days I'm going to replace, is if you hit that pothole, you probably would have blown out the two on the side where the pothole was. Both of them would have gone. Plus, you potentially would have damaged the frame of the wheel, and in which case the wheel would have to be replaced. I know this for a fact because I've already done it on my daughter's car. Not that I was driving it, but she was driving it. And they have lane markers in the south. They don't have these in the north because the plows would take them right off the road. But they have lane markers in the south. That are little humps on the road so that when you start to go from one lane to another, the tire picks them up and you can hear them ticking and you know that you've changed lanes. You can also see them reflect. Well, to make sure that some people don't jump out of turning lanes, they're much bigger. They're about the half the size of a basketball, and they look like, you know, half-size basketballs all lined up. Hit one of those with those small tires, and not only will it take the air out of the tire, and in this case, when she hit it as she was turning, but she turned too narrow, so the two right-hand tires took the brunt. Not only did it take the air right out of the tires, it blew them off the rims, and then the rims cut through the tires so that they couldn't even be replaced. And now because the rim was on the ground and she had to drive a little bit to pull the car over to a point where, you know, we could have AAA come out and fix things for her, the wheels took it in the shorts as well. So two wheels and two tires later, and I'm talking a little over $1,000. The other day I was behind a car that hit a pothole, had the same types of tires, blew out both left side tires, and then, of course, he slowly drove it down the road, turned left into a filling station to park. By that time, of course, the rims had cut right through the tires. And so he had lost the tires, and I knew right away that he had an over $1,000 expense, not only for two wheels, but for the two tires as well. So those little tires may look really decorative and cute and, you know, wonderful and hip, and I don't know what you call them these days, but I can tell you that they're the biggest waste of money I've ever seen on an automobile in my entire life. And they don't really look that good because on trucks, they look like you're on you're running wagon wheels on your truck. That's what it looks like to me. So the only thing missing on your truck is a white canvas over the bed and behind the truck. But I think that some things that you really want to take a look at is you can get standard tires on those cars, and yeah, it's not as fancy and hot roddy and, you know, and as we used to call it, and maybe looking today-ish and modern, and I don't know what you want to look for on those things. But I can tell you that, to me, with having those big rims and those tiny tires, it's the biggest waste of money I've ever seen in my life. I would put regular tires on there with regular wheels on there so that if I tapped a curb at some time or hit one of those little city markers that's in the street or the turning lanes, the only thing that I'm going to do is damage the city marker, and my tire is going to roll right over the top of it. And that's exactly what I would want to have done. So use your money wisely, and that's what I think about car debt. I think cars are very good, and it gets you obviously from point A to point B and back again. But one does have to take a look and make sure that you are spending your money wisely and you're getting the right thing out of the investment that you're going to put into. And a car is an investment. A car is something that you're going to have for a long period of time. And we know that you bought it obviously because you like it or you need it, and you need to get from one point to another. And that's why you have this automobile. So realize that you're going to have to put money in it. And that's called tires, and it's called gasoline, and it's called oil, and it's called, you know, periodic maintenance. And maybe you don't want to drive down the road with, you know, mud caked over it all the time. And so you're going to have to give it a bath every once in a while, whether you do that in your driveway or whether you take it to a car wash. All those things add up when you have a car. And, oh, by the way, the resale value went down about $1,000 when you drove it out of the dealership, whether it was a new or used car. It went down about $1,000, so your retail sale value went down. And then when you sell it, you might not get absolutely everything out of it that you planned on in the first place. And so, therefore, if you were to ask somebody like me, is a car a good investment? I would tell you today that a car is a good investment if it is a cream puff 1930 Ford, because if you're going to sink money into an automobile, at least sink money into an automobile that today is rare and you can't get it. And it is an investment because it, whatever money you put into it, if somebody else wants that and there's only like one or two of them left in the world and that's what they really want, they're going to pay a lot of money to take it off your hands. So antique cars and rare cars, to me, are a good investment. An automobile is an investment only to the point that it gets me from point A to point B, and that's all it is on my books. And so do I want to put a loan on my car? Sure, I'll put a loan on my car. But I will also make it a very short-term loan, and I'll make sure I pay it off quickly. So I've got to have a lot of savings so that I take a down payment on my car before I take out the loan. Don't take the full amount of the automobile as a loan over a 7-year period of time when you know that the car is only going to last for 36 months or 48 months, and you've got this thing extended out for a 7-year period of time. And because if you paid it off in the first 36 months and you keep a car for as long as, say, I do, then the next 4 years you don't have an automobile payment other than maintenance, and so you're saving that money. And save that money, put it away, and if you're able to save that money and put it away, then you have a larger down payment on another automobile where you can shorten up the time frame of the loan. Now, does the financial institution care? Well, sort of, but sort of not. At least they're getting a loan for a period of time. And if you're putting a lot of money down, you're a good credit risk, so your FICO score is going to go up. And they're going to want to do business with you. So put the money away for an automobile before you decide that's what you want to do. So for all those kids that listen to this show, and not a lot of them do, but for all those kids that potentially may listen to the show at some time in the future because it's on the Internet and will be here forever and ever, this is what I would suggest that you do. As you're mowing lawns and doing all those types of things, as your summer chores come up after May and June and you're out of school and planning for your future and realizing that at some time in the future, maybe when I'm 16 years old, I would love to have my own car, and that's what I want to do for going on to senior high. I want to be able to drive my own car. If that is what you want to do, then start putting money away and never touch it. Just put money away for this automobile that you're going to have when you're 16 or 17 years old. And if you continue to do that all during the period of time, you will be able to start out right by putting money down on a 1930 black Ford and be able to have this a wonderful automobile that is worth a lot of money. Or you can buy just a car that gets you from point A to point B, and the air conditioning works and the heater works and the floorboards aren't rusted out, and you can get to school and back, and that's what you want to use it for, and to work and back and be able to make the payments on it, and that's, they're all good. We're all good. So Anyway, I see that we're getting to the about 1 minute before our show is really going to end, and I can hear the music coming in. The engineer is laying that underneath me, so he's letting me know that I've only got about 60 seconds left, but I wanted to let you know that it certainly has been wonderful talking with you again. Sorry we've missed each other for a couple of weeks, and we'll attempt not to do that again in the future. You can always give us a call again at 646-929-1020, or you can leave a message for us on Blog Talk Radio, Your Money, Your Matters, brought to you by the Cornerstone Credit Union League, the Cornerstone Credit Union Foundation, and Consumer Credit Counseling Service of Greater Dallas. This is Rick Grady. I had a great time talking with you today, and hopefully you have a great week. We'll talk to you in 1 week.